Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
I have to ask, is Marjorie Taylor Greene now part of the Republican establishment?
Well, I think, Brian, that she's fallen between two bar stools. She's neither an establishment person, nor is she a member in good standing of the House Freedom Caucus. What she is, though, I think, is a person with far-right beliefs who has become a very powerful member of the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I think what we learn from her tells us a lot about the Republican Party writ large.
That's been my theory of the case for a long time now, that Greene, who by all rights should have been kind of kicked to the curb or put in the Star Wars bar of Republican outliers, slowly, first by her fundraising ability and then by her association with Trump, became a favorite of Kevin McCarthy and soon vaulted really to be a big power player within the GOP.
That's Robert Draper there, staff writer and domestic correspondent at the New York Times, and the author of several books, most recently, Weapons of Mass Delusion, When the Republican Party Lost Its Mind. What a title. And I'm Brian Stelter. Let me welcome you to Vanity Fair's Inside the Hive, where this week, we're going inside Congress. Marjorie Taylor Greene was most recently in the news because she was kicked out of the far-right House Freedom Caucus. But let's be clear, she wasn't kicked out for being moderate. She was ejected for calling fellow lawmaker Lauren Boebert a bitch, and for working with Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy. You know, the Georgia congresswoman first gained national attention for her conspiracy theories, for her QAnon friendliness. But now that she's in office, she's had a couple of years in Congress, let's be clear. It's not as if she has dramatically changed. She still wants to use her power to pass bills, to criminalize trans care, to impeach Joe Biden, and to halt all immigration for 4 years. Many people view this as a very dangerous and radical agenda. But here's the thing. In the current fractured GOP-controlled House, MTG has emerged as a surprisingly canny political operator. So, Robert, let me bring you back in. Let's talk about that. You've been doing reporting about this for years. You've interviewed MTG just in the past few days. How has she evolved in the past couple of years?
It goes sort of step by step, as you've alluded, Brian. She came into Congress, seems almost by accident. The local press paid very little attention to her until she was about to win her primary. By the time they focused attention on her, she was facing a weak Democratic opponent who then dropped out. Still, her frequent and fairly recent social media posts relating to QAnon, relating to how Nancy Pelosi should be executed for treason, made her a pariah from the moment that she came to Washington. And Republicans wanted nothing to do with her. Democrats were disgusted by her. And very soon, really a month into her being a member, succeeded in having her removed from her two committees. At that point, you would have figured that Greene would have just been, you know, left to mumble with herself. But instead, she raised a ton of money off of her being kicked off of those committees and began to tour around the U.S., began to promote her proximity and loyalty to Donald Trump. And before long, it became clear to Kevin McCarthy, who was aching to be Speaker of the House, that he had better placate her. And he began to do so, promising her plum committee assignments, having her sit in on top-level policy meetings. And so she, in turn, repaid the favor when the Republicans just barely won the majority in 2022 by pronouncing herself an ally of McCarthy and actually whipping in support of his bid for the speakership. And I say, as the really important thing, convinced Donald Trump to call other individuals who are holding out, saying basically, knock it off, Kevin's our guy. And so McCarthy said, after all of this, I'm never going to leave this woman. And so she's been at the table. She has gotten good committee assignments, and she's had a real influence on which bits of legislation come to the floor.
It sounds like she was able to convert her pariah status into popularity, right?
Yeah. And another thing happened, too, along the way, Brian, even as she came to be regarded as more of a serious person, it actually became a self-fulfilling prophecy to the degree that she stopped viewing the mainstream media in adversarial terms. Now is far more accessible than she'd ever been before. I had interviewed her a lot for my book, but she told me after McCarthy became speaker that she no longer wanted to use phrases like enemy of the American people and fake news, that she didn't see any fruit to having a kind of adversarial relationship with the press. And she has also begun to talk more to middle-of-the-road Republicans instead of regularly demonizing them on Twitter. So she's, I hesitate to say, begun behaving like an adult, because she still espouses extreme positions, particularly as regards transgender individuals and matters relating to the border. But at least in terms of how she comports herself within her conference, she's definitely evolved.
Yeah, your point about her accessibility to the media is really interesting. She was on 60 Minutes, interviewed by Leslie Stahl, and here's what she said about some of her extreme views.
When I'm outspoken about it and I take my stand or my position, the first reaction is, Marjorie's crazy. Marjorie's extreme. Marjorie's a right-wing extremist. And then what will happen is my colleagues will go back home to their district and their own constituents are coming up and saying, are you supporting Marjorie? Do you agree with Marjorie? Have you co-sponsored Marjorie's bill? And then they find out, oh, maybe she's not crazy. And then they end up agreeing with me.
She's kind of onto something. I mean, one can make too much of this because it's not a scientific survey. But the reality is that the activist base of the Republican Party, the people most likely to show up to town halls, the people most likely to call in to members of Congress, to their offices, to confront them at public events, are those people who are supportive of Donald Trump and, by extension, of Marjorie Taylor Greene. And so, yes, they're the loudest voices in the room. They're the ones that you hear. Now, they're not the only voters, but they're the ones who reliably will show up. And right. So that does have an influence. And a lot of her colleagues wish that she wouldn't talk in the manner that she does. They wish, frankly, that she would go away. But they know as well, they've come to learn, that she is representative of the activist faction of the Republican Party that happens to be very MAGA-oriented. And so in a way, whether they like it or not, she provides a kind of litmus test as to what the base is thinking and feeling.
So help us get into her head, if you can, Robert. What do you think really drives Marjorie Taylor Greene? And what has been surprising about talking to her?
Well, I think, look, I think this may sound banal, Brian, but like a lot of human beings, she looks for meaning in her life. And I think that some people have made the miscalculation about Greene that all she wants is attention. I do think attention is important to her, but I don't think that that's all. I think that she also wants to have an impact on America, whether you or I or others like it or not. She is of the view that America has gone wayward, that the America that she and the rest of us are living in now is not the America that she recognizes, not the America that she has loved. And so I think she wants to make things happen. I think that she wants to get legislation passed. She made clear to me that she wants to have a president who upholds Christian values. She embraces the term Christian nationalist. She believes that that just means a Christian who loves this country. But she also acknowledges that it's someone who believes that Christianity should be at the forefront of American life, including American policymaking. That's what she wants. And so I think that not always consciously, but in, you know, the sort of 30,000 foot sense is what she's trying to achieve in America.
You say there are lawmakers, GOP lawmakers, who wish she'd go away, wish she wasn't part of the party. Wishing, of course, won't make it so. But when they say that, I assume they're saying that quietly or privately. I mean, are any of them willing to say it publicly?
No, they don't say it publicly because then, of course, they'll get the phone calls, right? They'll get grief from their constituents, even from people they've never heard of. They could even get death threats. And I'm not making light of that. I mean, that kind of thing can happen. There's nothing fruitful for them to say on a TV camera, God, what were the people in the 14th district of Georgia thinking of when they elected this woman? Please, please nominate somebody else next time. That's simply not going to happen.
Right. That's true. When it comes to Marjorie Taylor being off the Freedom Caucus, fill us in on what happened. Apparently she called another GOP lawmaker, Lauren Boebert, an ugly word.
Yeah, there's been a lot of friction between Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene almost from the moment that they both came in through the class of 2020, both as freshmen, Boebert from Colorado, Greene from Georgia, both of them with zero legislative or political experience, and both of them very much in the kind of, you know, performance artist wing of the Republican Party. And Greene has said to me that from the outset, she attempted to help Boebert both when it came to staffing and when it came to fundraising, but that they never were able to develop collegial relations. She felt like that from Boebert's camp, there was a lot of backbiting and snarky comments about her. So it's never been substantive. It's always been personal. But as Boebert took sides with Matt Gaetz and with the House Freedom Caucus in being united in their opposition to Kevin McCarthy, I say united with the asterisk of Jim Jordan, who in a lot of ways is the godfather of the Freedom Caucus and therefore, I guess, gets a pass in all of this. They found themselves on the opposite side of Marjorie Taylor Greene, who was unflagging in her support of McCarthy and has made comments favorable to McCarthy and to whatever the Republican leadership is doing, which is just not what the Freedom Caucus is up to. So you could argue that there was a substantive disagreement between those two, and yet it also is something you could say about Jordan. In the end, this is a personal thing. And Greene also has made clear, I have to say this, Brian, I've written it in my book, but it otherwise really hasn't been reported on. Greene has been open and taking to task the House Republicans, who in 2017, with a Republican president, with a Republican majority in the Senate, could have run the table and could have done a whole bunch of things, in her view. And she said they shat the bed, you know, and that goes with the Freedom Caucus. Nothing was ever good enough for them. They said no to everything. I want to be a serious legislator. So fast forward to the present. Now they have the majority. And Greene has been open in saying to the party of no within the Republican Party, when are you guys going to be satisfied? Do you ever want to get anything done? And she's essentially said, you know, you're nothing but an exalted fight club. And so that friction on top of the personal animus between her and Boebert has led to, you know, where we are now, to her being booted out.
When you cover all this for a living, do you feel like you're covering like middle school fights?
Yeah, I've never seen this level of schoolyard taunting and juvenile misbehavior that I've seen amongst these Republicans. And I have to say, you know, you'll recall, Brian, when there was discussion amongst the House Republicans in 2021 about whether or not to remove Liz Cheney from her leadership position as head of the conference chair, and a secret meeting the House Republicans did to air their dissatisfactions with Cheney, while Cheney herself sat there. I have the recording of that and have listened to it. And it's really amazing to listen to them. I mean, they sound like a bunch of babies. You know, one of them, Ralph Norman, had said, you know, it's like you look up at the stands and you see your girlfriend cheering for the other team. And somebody yelled out, she's not your girlfriend. And but I mean, that I have talked to a lot of Democrats who have engaged in real intra-party disputes, but it's never been as juvenile, as sophomoric as that.
Never as juvenile as it is with today's GOP. All right, quick break here. Much more with Robert Draper on the other side.
The There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Hive. And welcome back to Vanity Fair's Inside the Hive. I'm Brian Stelter. We're going behind the scenes right now about the House GOP, about Marjorie Taylor Greene as a force within the House GOP. And I'm talking with Robert Draper of the New York Times. Robert, in your book, Weapons of Mass Delusion, you describe where she came from, so to speak, her origin story. What was Marjorie Taylor Greene doing before she was elected to Congress?
Yeah, well, she worked at her family-owned construction company. It was founded by her father. She also had her own CrossFit gym that she owned. If you had sat next to her on an airplane, Brian, she would have reminded you of every blonde, suburban, conservative, Southern woman you'd ever met. She was pretty apolitical. That began to change when Trump became president. She felt an immediate affinity for him, felt then correspondingly that the so-called Russia collusion hoax proved that not only were people out to get Trump, the elites were, but also that the media couldn't be trusted. That gave her, in turn, a permission structure to use the classic phrase, do her own research, which meant going down the rabbit hole and falling into the QAnon community. And she began to post on Facebook and on YouTube, became, you know, had a significant following. And these were the, you know, the things you referenced before about that the wildfires of California were perhaps started by space lasers that were orchestrated by the famous Jewish family, the Rothschilds, that some of these mass shootings were false flag operations, that 9/11 wasn't real, that Barack Obama...
I'm sorry, that 9/11 wasn't real?
Yeah. The 9/11 was staged. In particular, the plane that crashed into the Pentagon, she didn't believe it. And don't ask me why. I'll have to, like, you know.
Yeah, no, it makes you crazy trying to understand and unpack the
so
crazy.
So she did all of this stuff, and she would go to these conferences where people would espouse the same thing. She would go to the border. So she was becoming a real activist. She also began going to Washington to show up to harass the offices of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of Nancy Pelosi, but also to request meetings from Republican senators. And this was the interesting thing. She'd go to these, you know, she'd go to the offices of her two Republican senators in Georgia, for example, and they would give her the high hat. They would ignore her. They'd show her the door, same with when she'd go to Marco Rubio's office and Ted Cruz's office. She came to feel really slighted as an American conservative taxpayer about this. And finally, basically said, screw it. I'm going to run for the House. And I'm going to go there and make a difference, not only because these people won't give me the time of day, but also because, frankly, I don't think they're doing all that they should be doing. You know, she was a self-funder because she was a millionaire as a result of her construction company, had to be taken seriously, but was running against a woman, Karen Handel, who was a favorite amongst conservatives, was a loyalist to Trump. Didn't look like she was going to win. Then another district opened up, the 14th district, and essentially as a carpetbagger, she moved into it, but began knocking on doors, talking to people. It's a much more conservative district. They took to her right away. She swamped the field. It was just as she was going into the runoff of her primary that news outlets, including CNN, began to put out some of her more alarming social media posts, which had been cataloged in opposition research, but nobody was interested, not locally, not nationally. They didn't give a
damn about
this.
You know what it reminds me of a little bit? It reminds me of George Santos a little bit. That the info was there, but it did not actually get amplified to a local or national audience before she won.
And Brian, you've covered this before yourself. Some of this bespeaks the how strapped for resources local media is. I mean, this is a far-flung congressional district. The major city is Rome, Georgia. There's another one, Dalton, Georgia, but not a big metropolis. A far drive for an Atlanta reporter who already has Senate races to cover or presidential to cover. No one paid any attention until it was essentially too late and she had it wrapped up. So she did all of this without the support of Trump. But when she won her primary, Trump called her right away. So did Kevin McCarthy. After those QAnon posts and stuff had been published, certain Republican leaders, like Steve Scalise, for example, the whip at the time, the minority whip in the House, denounced Green. But McCarthy held his tongue, and she took note of that. And so that, in a lot of ways, formed the basis of the alliance that later came.
And that alliance is so interesting, and that's what we keep coming back to here. Because as you write in the very introduction to your book, Weapons of Mass Delusion, you write about the tension between the reality-based wing of the Republican Party and the lost-its-mind wing of the Republican Party. You, frankly, are describing a candidate, a newly elected congresswoman here, who was part of the lost-its-mind wing of the party, talking about 9/11 as a hoax, for example. But all of a sudden, the reality-based wing has to find ways to work with the lost-its-mind wing. I mean, it's been an extraordinary scenario for a few years now.
Yeah, Brian, and it's that, and so the reality-based wing then became the lost-its-nerve wing. It's not that they have to find a way to work with them because they feel like they need to listen to their considered opinions, et cetera. It's that Kevin McCarthy, in particular, took stock of the fact that Marjorie Taylor Greene was not an outlier, that she represented a faction of the Republican Party that was not going to go away. That's the Donald Trump MAGA faction. He came to recognize, McCarthy did, that Green was essentially a spokesperson for that wing. And so it was not out of like personal affection or pity or anything else that he began to court Green. It was that she was the proximate warrior for the MAGA movement. And that movement was one that he needed if he wanted to get to the House majority, and needed as well if he wanted to maintain the majority. So those are the dynamics. It came to be seen that the lost its mind wing of the Republican Party was where all the action was where the passion was, and wasn't going to go away anytime soon. Still hasn't gone away.
Is your impression from interviewing her and interviewing colleagues that Marjorie Taylor Greene is the same person behind closed doors, the same person in private as she is in public?
For the most part, she freely admits, at least to me, that she hyperbolizes her effect because that's what wins in the attention economy. That's what gets you more support, more financial support, et cetera. Behind closed doors, that gets tuned down some, which is not to say that she does not believe what she says. She believes enough of what she says, but she checks some of the hyperbole at the door. And she has become a cannier legislative player. She understands parliamentary procedure, who, by the way, some of that was taught to her by Mark Meadows when she got kicked off of the committees. And she wondered what to do with all this abundance of free time she now had. It was Meadows who proactively suggested to her, why don't you gum up the works of the Democratic majority by doing all these motions? So it's interesting that Meadows has played this backstage role in her evolution. She now reads legislation much more carefully. She crafts legislation. She and her staff do. You know, her chief of staff is this guy, Ed Buckham, who was the chief of staff of Tom DeLay. Now, Tom DeLay, for those of your listeners who don't know, was arguably the most powerful Republican in town as the first as the majority whip and later as the majority leader of the House during the Newt Gingrich era and thereafter. And whatever one thinks of him personally, was a very, very savvy legislative operator. And so that she brought on a DeLay alum to be her chief of staff indicates to you her desire to get things done and a recognition that she knows what she doesn't know and needs the help of more able people around her.
Since she was sworn in just days before the January 6th insurrection, how has she approached, handled, followed up on the insurrection and on the Justice Department investigation into the attack?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene in this way, I think also is a kind of personification of the confusion amongst conservatives relating to January the 6th and other things about it, because you can hear in the very same paragraph, Greene and individuals that she represent first say what happened at the Capitol was terrible, but after all, the election was stolen and people have a right to react the way they did. Secondly, to say that there actually was nothing that bad at all that took place. It was, as her colleague in Georgia, Andrew Clyde, said, you know, an ordinary tourist event. Third, that there was violence, but as we all know, conservatives never engage in violence. It's the other side that does. So these were Antifa elements who did that. And fourth, finally, that in fact, this was all a setup by the feds, perhaps in concert with Nancy Pelosi. And the phrase, the feds' erection, is one that they've now embraced. So there's all of that about what took place that day. Then there is what happened to the individuals who participated in it. And Greene has been at the forefront of claiming that these people who are arrested, indicted, and either awaiting trial, have already been sentenced, are being politically persecuted.
Let me take a quick break here. More with Robert Draper in just a minute.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back here on Vanity Fair's Inside the Hive. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Robert Draper of the New York Times. So, Robert, you split your time between the magazine and now as a domestic correspondent for the Times. One of your pieces earlier this year described this governance by chaos, right? And so 6 months into McCarthy's tenure, he has the help of figures like Marjorie Taylor Greene. Is it striking that he has not been severely challenged for the job, that he has not been pushed out yet? I mean, that was all the talk in January when all this started.
I'm glad you asked that question, Brian, because I was talking to a Democratic member of Congress last night about this, and he said, you know, you have to, in a way, salute McCarthy because he has already defied expectations. Those expectations were low. The belief was that McCarthy wouldn't last 3 or 4 months, because among the key things that he agreed to, key concessions that allowed him to become speaker, was that he would allow one person from the Republican conference to stand up and initiate a motion to vacate, which in essence would open the door to a vote on whether or not to remove McCarthy, that could be done at any time. So you'd figure he'd be spending all this time dancing on a razor's edge, and I suppose he has, but there has not been any serious attempt to dethrone him. That's in part, I think, because he has kept the Freedom Caucus at the table. I think McCarthy has shown himself, frankly, to no surprise to a lot of us who've watched him throughout the years, to be a consummate survivor. But the closer we get to the election cycle and the more influence we see of the MAGA base, I think the more heartburn he's going to have and the more it's going to become obvious that he'll have to choose one side over the other. For that matter, we have an appropriations battle coming up that is almost certain to lead to a government shutdown. I covered this 10 years ago when what was becoming the House Freedom Caucus, it wasn't formalized yet, forced a government shutdown. And you know, I remember guys like Raul Labrador saying, you know, nah, it's not that big a deal. But they were in a very distinct minority. Nowadays, members of the Freedom Caucus and their base back home say, hell yeah, we should shut the government down. You know, the less we see of the government, the better. And, you know, this is going to disrupt veterans' benefits, the opening and closing of parks, and other things that their constituents will soon be howling about. But for the moment, there seems to be every reason to believe that the far right, the Freedom Caucus, and others like them are going to force a shutdown.
Mm. In your author's note for Weapons of Mass Delusion, which came out last year, you write about your late father, Bob, and how he was a lifelong Republican. And by the end of his life, he wanted the Democrats to defeat Trump and restore some sanity to the Republican Party. Now, you know, a few years into the Biden era, do you think your father would even recognize this environment anymore?
Well, my father, who was indeed a diehard Republican, I think he would be deeply despondent about where the Republican Party is, would be hard-pressed to find heroes amongst them. On his literal deathbed, he was saying, I hope that Joe Biden becomes the nominee. This was in November of 2019, because I think he and only he in that Democratic field is capable of bringing enough independents on board to defeat Donald Trump, which to my father's mind was the thing that absolutely needed to happen. It was Trump, he believed, who had rendered the party unrecognizable. I think that what my father would be chagrined to see is that the removal of Trump from the White House has not moved the Republican Party back into the GOP he once knew.
And now we're in an environment where there's talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene as a potential running mate for Trump in the future, a vice presidential candidate in the future. And she is someone who goes on 60 Minutes and says Democrats are pedophiles. Here's the clip.
I would definitely say so. They support grooming children.
They are not pedophiles. Why would you say that?
Democrats support, even Joe Biden, the president himself, supports children being sexualized and having transgender surgeries. Sexualizing children is what pedophiles do to children.
Wow. Okay. But my question really is, can't you fight for what you believe in without all that name-calling and without the personal attacks?
Well, I would ask the same question to the other side, because all they've done is call me names and insult me nonstop since I've been here, Leslie. They call me racist. They call me anti-Semitic, which is not true. I'm not calling anyone names. I'm calling out the truth, basically.
Pedophile?
Call it what it is. Anyone that
Green, knows. In her tete-a-tete with Leslie Stahl there, I think offered a kind of master class or at least a representation in how the extreme right deals with processes and otherwise deals with these charges against them of being too extreme. They first conflate things, and those are enormous and offensive leaps of logic that you nonetheless see on the right frequently. The other thing that she did just a few seconds later was instigate a little round of whataboutism. So it's to me, the question has always been, you know, well, what do you believe? And they would rather not answer that question. They'd rather instead say, well, we do this because that side does that. Well, you don't like that side doing that. Is that just to say that we now live in a state of moral anarchy? Or does it mean that you're being a hypocrite here? And Stahl kind of let that one get away from her, I think.
So how do you keep your mind clear when covering the Lost Its Mind party?
You know, Brian, I view as my job trying to understand why people do what they do. I admit that it has become increasingly difficult when you're talking to individuals who themselves give conflicting arguments about why they do what they do. I gave January the 6th as one notion, but another one would also be COVID, right? Do they believe vaccines are ineffectual? Do they believe that they're a Chinese bioweapon? You can hear people say conflicting, you know, contradictory things in the same breath. And that's a little bit headache inducing, but I don't think that the solution is to ignore it altogether. And to me, it's a valuable service to try to understand, you know, the functioning of our democracy really depends on the health of two robust political parties. And when one party falls ill, it's important to understand why. If that party becomes sort of terminally diseased, then that in turn is going to have effects in our democracy writ large.
I couldn't have said it better. Robert Draper, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me on.
And once again, Robert Draper of the New York Times, his most recent book, Weapons of Mass Delusion. I love it as a guide to understanding the modern day GOP. This episode was produced by Michael May. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. And we had engineering assistance from Jake Loomis and mixing by Bob Mallory. I'm Brian Stelter. You can find me on Twitter at Brian Stelter. Same thing on Threads. And you should email us anytime. Send us your feedback, your ideas for future shows. The email address is bstelter@gmail.com. We'll be right back here in your podcast feed this time next week.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours. On the new season of Long Shadow, I delve into the complicated history of firearms from the Second Amendment to the AR-15. I try to make sense of how we got here and how we might find a path forward. From Longlead, PRX, and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, In Guns We Trust. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.